Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Nir Rosen, who is a journalist who has covered Iraq in the sense that he has ventured out of the Green Zone, has spoken with the insurgents, and has been extremely prescient and accurate all along. And he now contributes to IraqSlogger.com. He's a fellow at the New American Foundation and the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. We'll also talk to an Army veteran, a highly decorated 30-year Army veteran, Colonel Bill Chamberlain. We'll be talking to him about the extent to which the surge that the American Enterprise Institute has recommended, in fact, the American Enterprise Institute is arguably the government since the Bush and Cheney administration, have circumvented the normal channels of government. They have Frederick Kagan's plan for a surge appears to be the blueprint for which President Bush will announce this week. So we'll be talking to Colonel Chamberlain about the extent to which this will break the army. And we will also talk with Dr. Roger Stern, who's an economic geographer at Johns Hopkins University. He's authored a study on the state of the Iranian oil fields, and some of his findings were used in an op-ed piece by the Iranian UN ambassador in the New York Times, which, of course, Roger Stern disagrees with, but the point of his study indicates that Iran is, their oil fields are in terrible shape. The domestic demands and subsidies are depleting them at an alarming rate, and that there may actually be an argument which they have proffered the Iranians for nuclear power, given the state of their oil fields. So we're looking into that. I'm now speaking with Nir Rosen, who is a contributor to IraqSlogger.com. He's a fellow at the New American Foundation and the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. And Nir Rosen, just to touch on this story that's on the website, IraqSlogger.com, speculating, and I believe there's some evidence to support this, that Muqtada Sadr himself may well have placed the noose around Saddam's neck. And the people in the chamber, of course, were chanting, Muqtada, Muqtada. It doesn't seem to me to be particularly surprising that that would be the case, given that Saddam killed most of Sadr's family, and revenge is a dish served cold. So, what's the evidence that you have, or that has been found so far for this?
I actually don't think that Muqtada Sadr did it. I think it's a rumor, and in fact, I'm convinced it's probably impossible. Muqtada Sadr, I think, has only been to Baghdad once in 2003, so I don't think he would make the perilous journey now. What's important about this isn't that it's true; it's that Sunnis believe it's true.
I see.
There was a chubby guy with a mask and a beard who was hanging Saddam, but that's hardly unusual. The similarities were to basically that extent. I mean, you had a chubby guy and a beard in the ring. That could have been any of a million Shia men.
And the ring is not particularly distinctive?
No, in fact, the ring is very typical of a Shia in Iraq. It's a traditional ring worn by Shias. And the reason people were shouting Muqtada is simply because most of the security forces in Iraq and the interior ministry forces are dominated by supporters of Muqtada Sadr. So they weren't cheering for Muqtada himself, but in the sense that he was there, they were just cheering because this is truly a victory for the Sadrists, the followers of Muqtada's father and great uncle, who certainly the great uncle was definitely executed by Saddam, and Shias believe that Muqtada Sadr's father was killed by Saddam. I actually don't think he was killed by the Ba'athists. I think it was an internal Shia feud. But again, I don't think the truth matters so much as the perception of the truth in Iraq.
And in terms of the military surge, just to change the subject a little, I spoke recently with Flint Leverett, the former CIA specialist on Iran and Iraq, who was on the National Security Council, both under Presidents Clinton and George W. Bush. And he's being censored by the White House. His op-ed piece for the New York Times was censored because he talked about the number of missed opportunities where the Iranians, particularly after the fall of the statue of Saddam on April the 9th of 2003, when the Iranians came through the back channel to the White House and said they were scared that they'd be next and said, we want to talk, anything and everything's on the table. We have authority from the Supreme Leader, et cetera, et cetera. And Cheney gave them the back of the hand and said, we don't talk to evil. They censored that, but one of the things that Flint said was that he believes that one of the reasons the White House is sensitive about talking about missed diplomatic opportunities with Iran is that they, in fact, plan to attack Iran as an exit strategy from Iraq. Have you heard that rumor, or does that make, not that we're necessarily dealing with a rational group of players here, but does that make any sense to you?
Well, I've talked to many military officers and over the past few years, and they have been expecting to go to Iran, and they've been briefed on it, and they've been preparing contingency plans. A part of this might just be normal, but I do think that there's always been an intention to go after Iran, and that was the ultimate goal. In fact, while I was researching my book, I was doing searches for newspaper articles on Iraq and the region. And it was fascinating to see that in May and June of 2003, the entire American media establishment was so euphoric about the war in Iraq that the entire discussion was, should we go after Iran now, or how should we go after Iran? But everybody took it for granted that Iran was next. Now, I think had Iraq gone well for the Americans, they would certainly have gone after Iran. But the fact that Iraq became such a catastrophe, they just became bogged down in Iraq, and they don't have the troops to go into Iran. They might be able to strike it from the air, but there is absolutely no way they could invade Iran. They don't have the numbers. Moreover, a land invasion of Iran would be much more difficult. Where would they do it from? They could try from the Persian Gulf, but the Iranians would be waiting for them. The Iranian army is not the Iraqi army. It's much better trained and more nationalistic. They would put up a fight. This would be much more difficult than Iraq, and their global repercussions would, of course, be tremendous. It would just be a very foolhardy thing to do. But this administration is so foolish that I wouldn't put anything past them.
But what about the possibility of some kind of vengeful punitive strike? For example, going after Muqtada Sadr, Sadr City, I believe, is even more thorny and difficult than southern Lebanon is. So perhaps if they used air power, and then would that provoke the Iranians and somehow come up with a pretext to attack them, not with an army but with air power?
Well, I think that the Israeli war against Lebanon, specifically their attempt to destroy Hezbollah in July of 2006, was the first step in the American war against Iran. But, of course, that didn't go well either. They had hoped, I think, to neutralize Hezbollah and to give a warning to the Iranians. But Hezbollah performed so well that I think it might have scuppered the American plan. I don't think that they could provoke Iran by attacking Iraqi Shias. I think they would be provoking Iraqi Shias, and that would be an even greater catastrophe, because you already have the Sunni population rising up against you, and you have some Shia resistance in Iraq. But the last thing I would want to do if I was an American would be to provoke a massive Shia resistance to the American occupation, because then you're really in trouble. They just have the numbers that they can throw men at people. That's when you end up with a 1975 Vietnam scenario where you got guys hanging off of helicopters fleeing Baghdad.
But, Nirozhan, isn't that exactly what the surge is intended to do? The administration has been complaining to al-Maliki's government for the longest time that they're not reining in the militias, and that's a code word for not reining in Muqtada Sadr. So isn't it logical that this new surge is in fact designed to go after and disarm the real player in all of this chaos, which is Muqtada Sadr?
That might be their hope, but it's an absolute fantasy. They cannot do that, in part because the police in Iraq are the Mahdi army. The army in Iraq is a Mahdi army. Much of the Shia population is a Mahdi army. So they would have to go house to house and disarm hundreds of thousands of Shia homes if they were to do this, because every Iraqi home has at least a Kalashnikov, and often much more than a Kalashnikov. So I believe this is a scenario where Americans would just be slaughtered. So the surge is just basically sacrificing American lives for absolutely nothing. It's such a foolish idea that can't accomplish anything. You cannot change the trajectory of Iraq now. The civil war is so intense that it's going to continue unabated until you have basically a Baghdad devoid of any Sunnis. This is where we're heading, sort of a genocide of Sunnis in Baghdad. The Americans aren't smart enough and don't have enough men or enough support to stop it. They're just one more militia, sort of lost and confused, far more concerned about force protection anyway. The idea that the Americans can affect any positive change in Iraq is absolutely naive at this point. It's just self-deception or deceiving the American population. Perhaps they're hoping to postpone the denouement in Iraq until the next president, because that 1975 Vietnam scenario is going to happen. Perhaps Bush wants it to happen on the next president's watch. So Bush is known as the guy who went down fighting, whereas the next guy is known as the guy who had to retreat from Iraq and lost Iraq.
Well, history's full of the delusions of leaders and tyrants, etc. And it seems to me that what the discussion is missing about Iraq and the debate, for what it's worth, and particularly in the press and in the opposition in this country, is that nobody seems to be pointing out the fact that these two draft dodgers, Cheney and Bush, are in fact cowards, because they are prosecuting this war because their own reputations are at stake. They don't have the guts or manliness, to quote Saddam Hussein, to admit that they've made a terrible mistake, and they're prepared to bleed more, lose more and more of our boys and girls' lives and limbs simply because they don't want to admit that they've made a mistake. And if your scenario is accurate, that they want to kick the can down the road to the next guy, that means more agony. But I don't believe history's on our side and time is on our side. I can't see you can string this thing out for another 2 years.
No, neither do I. I think Iraq will break up far before then, and not only will the Shias actually pursue their genocidal intent in Baghdad, not that Sunnis are innocent of similar things, but you're going to see far greater involvement of Sunni neighbors like Saudi Arabia and Jordan in support of the beleaguered Sunnis of Iraq. You're going to see this destabilizing Syria, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, perhaps Yemen, perhaps Bahrain, Kuwait. Really, the entire region is going to fall apart. The borders are going to be redrawn over the next decade. Leaders will be replaced. I think King Abdullah of Jordan won't survive the final act of the death of Iraq. It's absolutely true also that there's been a resistance or absolute denial by the administration. They've made any mistakes. Whereas they haven't done anything good. Nothing has gone right in Iraq. Every single thing they've done has broken the country, has destroyed the country, from the way they handled the war until the way Saddam's execution was handled. It's been just the murder of a country. And not only are Iraqis suffering, of course, more than anybody else, but American soldiers are dying for absolutely nothing, just to perpetuate this lie that there's some hope that Iraq can succeed.
But do you believe it's really comes down to the personal level, that the main architects, at least the people most responsible, the president and the vice president, simply don't have the courage to admit that they've made a mistake?
Yes, I think that's what it is. Of course, they might not actually believe they've made a mistake. President Bush, as a religious man, and has sort of, it seems like a religious epistemology, doesn't operate in a very rational level. He really seems to be ruling sort of by faith-based government. And he thinks that, at least according to his statements, that it's all a question of willpower. If you believe Iraq can succeed, then it will succeed. And the most important thing is not to lose your resolve. We believe it will succeed, therefore we'll succeed. That really seems to be his policy for Iraq. It's just steadfast resolution, as if your emotions can somehow affect reality. And perhaps if you're a devout Christian, that makes sense to you, but for us in the reality-based world, that's, of course, insane.
But the neoconservatives who are responsible for this kind of reckless utopian idea that you could bring democracy, almost like drive-by democracy, at the point of a gun, they are still very much in the saddle. The American Enterprise Institute seems to be the de facto National Security Council. The Frederick Kagan blueprint is basically what Bush is expected to endorse this coming week for the so-called surge. Is there any recognition anywhere in Washington that you know of that points out the incredible irony that the neoconservatives, who in many ways were motivated at least in part by their relationship to Netanyahu and the Likud right wing in Israel, have in fact brought about the unintended consequences, in the sense that the road to hell is paved with good intentions, that at the end of the day, if the scenario that you just briefly outlined, the destabilization of Syria and in particular Jordan, with continued Saudi funding, with angry insurgents driven out of their country, heavily armed and experienced, isn't it likely that they'll turn to the West, and there's nothing between Jordan and Syria to stop them from heading towards Israel?
I think that's partly true. I think they would first probably turn on the regimes in Jordan and Syria, because the regime in Syria is being sort of a split off from it's dominated by Alawites, who are kind of split off from Shias, now viewed as apostates or infidels by radical Sunnis, and Syria is a majority Sunni country. So they could perhaps join forces with the Sunni Muslim Brotherhood in Syria and destabilize Syria. They could, of course, threaten the regime in Jordan, which is effectively an American puppet with sort of fragile legitimacy. Indeed, that would put a more hostile state on the border with Israel. I, for one, don't see anything wrong with that. I fully support the Palestinian liberation of Israel. But I think that what the neocons fail to understand, and what what's far more important, is that it's the Palestinian problem that is the issue here, and that you can't do anything to protect Israel from the Palestinians. You have to protect Israel from itself. The leaders are so stupid. They think that they can crush the Palestinian will and the Palestinian spirit in much the same fashion that the Americans think they can crush the will of the Iraqi resistance. But occupations are bound to fail, and the Israeli occupation of Palestine is bound to fail. And the only solution for the Arab-Israeli conflict is a withdrawal of the occupation and a withdrawal of the settlements and the compensation of the refugees and a repatriation of the Palestinian refugees, and then perhaps you can see peace in the Middle East.
Well, that has been resisted over the years. The reverse has happened, in fact. We've had a peace process, but no peace, and the process seems to be to continue building settlements and to try and grind the Palestinians down, so that presumably, at least the Likud fantasy is that they'll all retreat into Jordan. But when you say a Palestinian liberation of Israel, what do you mean? That's provocative to a lot of listeners, I'm sure.
I think it's inevitable that Israel exists as a Jewish state eventually. The way that they're oppressing the population, the way that they're provoking all their neighbors. What Israel should have done is to seek to belong in the region, to seek peace with its neighbors. But I think, as Israeli historians and even former diplomats have shown, they've consistently rejected peace with their neighbors, with Syria, with Egypt. They could have long ago made peace with Syria simply by returning the Golan Heights, which they've illegally occupied since 1967. They could have long ago achieved the modus vivendi with the Palestinians had they withdrawn to the 1967 line, had they withdrawn the settlement, had they repatriated and compensated the Palestinian refugees. This is not only the moral thing to do, this is also consistent with international law and with countless UN resolutions on the issue. You cannot live in the region merely by force and intimidation. And perhaps the Hezbollah victory in this last war in Lebanon in July is one sign of that. The Israeli idea that force can work was proved to be an illusion when confronted with a fairly effective guerrilla movement. And they really failed to achieve all of their objectives. And indeed, the region is getting more and more hostile to the idea of peace with Israel, as Israel continues to wipe out the Palestinian spirit, to strangle the Palestinians every day. It's routine now. People don't even care that every single day Palestinian children are being slaughtered in Gaza and the West Bank. The entire world just ignores it. And what's fascinating is it's happening right in front of our eyes. Unlike Sudan, where it's very hard to be to work as a journalist or to even obtain a visa, Israel and Palestine are inundated with the foreign press. and the slaughter is happening in front of the entire world, and nobody really says anything, especially the West, which supports Israel. This slaughter of the Palestinians is occurring with American taxpayer money. We are funding the settlements. We are funding the Israeli military. We are funding the slow extermination of the Palestinian national identity and existence.
But, Neil Rosen, just in closing, though, you were suggesting earlier that the unintended consequences of this war in Iraq might well be the destabilization of Syria and Jordan. This was also alluded to by Brent Scowcroft, President Bush's father's national security advisor, in a recent piece in the New York Times. So wouldn't this mean, if the Muslim Brotherhood took over, if the Assad family regime was taken out, the Alawites, then the Muslim Brotherhood is most likely to succeed them, and would they go after Hezbollah, therefore?
Not necessarily. Not all Sunnis hate Shias. I mean, things are much more complex than that. In fact, Hezbollah was overwhelmingly popular in Egypt, for example, a Sunni state. So people differentiate between the Shias of Lebanon, who defy Israel, who defy the American plan for the Middle East, and the Shias of Iraq, whom they perceive as Iranian agents, as collaborators with the American occupation, as death squads slaughtering innocent Sunnis. They don't view all Sunnis and Shias as the same, but there is indeed a greater hostility to Shias in the region. Hezbollah's victory really inspired Palestinians, so many Palestinians are sympathetic with Hezbollah. It doesn't only come down to Sunni Shias, but it often depends upon whether the country is mixed or not. Egypt doesn't really have very many Shias, so it's not an issue with them. Saudi Arabia, having a Shia population in its very strategic oil regions, is very hostile to any sort of Shia empowerment. It just depends on what country you're talking about and their internal dynamics.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles and recommending to the audience that they go to iraqslogger.com, which you contribute to. And again, Neil Rosen is a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. Thank you for joining us, Neil.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Neil Rosen, who contributes to iraqslogger.com. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation and the author of In the Belly of the Green Bird, The Triumph of the Martyrs in Iraq. And he is one of the few journalists who ventures out of the green zone, in the sense that he even interviews the insurgents at great risk to himself. I'm now speaking with Colonel E.M. Bill Chamberlain, who's retired from the military in 2002. He is a highly decorated 30-year veteran of the United States Army. He was head of the Striker unit during Desert Storm. And Colonel Chamberlain, the surge that seems all but inevitable, the blueprint of which was generated at the American Enterprise Institute by Frederick Kagan just this week, as Senators McCain and Lieberman introduced it, and there's an expectation that it's pretty much the blueprint that President Bush is going to adopt this next week. Frankly, I've never seen anything quite like this in terms of a purge at the top. It's almost like ancient Rome. Many of the top military commanders, in spite of the fact that they say that they've been retired, it seems to me that Casey and Abizaid, one of the few Arabic-speaking generals that we have effectively been purged, have they not?
Yeah, I think you're right. This administration, since the beginning, and it was a surprise, actually. We did not anticipate George Bush to end up being like he was, or he is. You have two choices as an officer these days, a senior officer. You can go along, or you can get the hell out. And there's no middle ground. And what that's doing to us collectively is we're going from one bad plan to another because nobody's going to listen. Most of the generals, unfortunately, go along. Abizaid recently, back in, I guess, in December, maybe the end of November, said that he didn't think more troops would help. Well, that was right in line with the Baker Commission, right in line with anybody who's ever been in combat, who's any studied any of the military history, you know. But that was also not in line with what the president wanted to hear. So his retirement was imminent. Schumacher, Chief Staff of the Army, he went out on a limb and said, hey, you want to give me $7 billion, it's going to cost me $30 billion to fix the equipment in the Army. And that doesn't even begin to address the needs of the soldiers of the army. For instance, Rumsfeld promised, as we went into this 4 years ago, that we would be on a three-year rotation cycle. Soldiers would spend a year in Iraq, a year back home, kind of resting and refitting, and then a year training up, and then back in Iraq. And what's happened instead is you do a year in Iraq, you come home, your unit is literally disbanded. They go all the way down to 25% to 40% strength. The remainder of those soldiers are sent to other units, many of whom are gearing up to go right back into Iraq. Best case, you get a year at home, but you're really not home. You're out in the field training, preparing, taking all the new soldiers in to form cohesive units to go right back. So a year in, a year out, spent training and preparing, a year back in again. We have soldiers over there, Ian, who are on their fourth tour in Iraq. Young fellow in a battalion that I'm very close to last week was killed. He's on his fourth tour. You know, and you keep going back, and this we learned the hard way in Vietnam, you can only go back so many times before your number's up and you're going to die. And that's just not fair.
Well, there was a conservative Republican senator recently, Gordon Smith of Oregon, who made a speech on the Senate floor suggesting the dysfunction of our military policy, in the sense that every day the soldiers go out and, you know, patrol the same streets the same way and get blown up by the same bombs. And he went on to say it's absurd, but then he added it may even be criminal.
I would not disagree with that. I read that speech and I thought it was excellent. And I really gave him a lot of credit for standing up and making it. You know, in ancient Rome, you mentioned that a little while ago. I've just been doing some reading on that recently. You could be born to the senatorial class, which was the only way you could get into the Senate in the beginning of the original Roman Republic. But you were not allowed to join the Senate, even though you were born to that class in one of those families, which guaranteed you a place in the Senate, until you had served 20 years in the Army. What a marked difference we have today. I mean, how many people in Congress or even the White House or the administration have served? So we got people making policies and decisions to go to war and to sustain wars and to send more troops who have never been in combat, who have never held a young soldier as he died, and have absolutely no concept. They don't have a damn bit of knowledge of what they're asking, and they opt to.
But Colonel Chamberlain, it seems to me that at the heart of what's going on here is our leaders, particularly the president and the vice president, and it's sometimes hard to distinguish which of the two is really running the show. The bottom line seems to be that because their reputations are at stake, these two men don't seem to have the courage to admit that they've made a mistake. And whether they even know it, maybe they're in denial, but I think a lot of people have been telling them for a long time that this thing is going to hell in a handbasket. Doesn't it come down to the fact that these leaders, because their reputations are at stake, simply won't admit they've made a mistake and pull the plug, and they're the ones that are causing this bleeding of, and loss of life and limb of our boys and girls for a failed policy?
Oh, absolutely. You know, George Bush wants to be the commander-in-chief, and he likes to tell everybody he's a commander-in-chief. But, you know, the first responsibility of a commander is to take full responsibility for your actions and everything that your unit does or fails to do. You cannot be a good commander unless you have humility. Otherwise, you end up killing your soldiers. And, you know, their reputations, their historical legacy, whatever you want to term that, is not worth the life of a single American soldier. No man in this country is that important, not one, to be worth the life of a single American soldier. So we're staying there because they will not admit the mistake. They will not say, okay, mess that one up. You know, when we had the Beirut bombing way back when, I remember President Reagan came on the radio and the TV and he said, I am the commander-in-chief. I take full responsibility. I have not heard this commander-in-chief take responsibility for anything.
So given that you're a 30-year veteran, highly decorated soldier, I think it's fair to say, Bill, that you're politically conservative. What's the does this reflect your feelings? Reflect the broader attitudes within the military, and even, you know, obviously there's a tradition of civilian control. But where is the pushback going to come from here? Since we don't seem to have a very vigorous political opposition in this country, and we seem to have a press that were basically cheerleaders for this war going in. And still, you know, the president says the press don't tell you the good news. I think the truth of the matter is they don't really tell us the bad news.
Yeah, I would agree. I don't know, Ian, and that's, I've been chewing on that ever since I retired and this war started, because, first of all, if you go back to our Constitution, which is what we're all supposed to support and defend, I mean, the president took that oath, I took that oath. Constitution is very clear. We could go to war under two provisions. One is a declaration of war by Congress, and the second one is under the War Powers Act of 1973. And I guess that's the one we're kind of loosely using here, or the president is. And I say loosely because it's pretty stringent when you read the actual law, which I have done. As an example, it says that every 6 months the president will report to Congress as to the duration and objectives of any use of combat troops short of declared war. Well, I'm not hearing that. In Congress, the Republican Congress, they just rubber-stamped everything that they've done. I think the Democratically-controlled Congress, in fact, they sent the president a letter on Friday that said they're looking for a phased withdrawal. They have the latitude under the War Powers Act to pull this thing, pull the stopper, as you say, and finish it.
Well, it seems like the president, though, probably because of the Karl Rove's influence, since he's such a political and public relations wizard, seems to be trying to set another trap for the Democrats and daring them to cut the funding, which I don't think they want to do. So give us a sense of what they can do under the War Powers Act, and if they don't want to fall for the political trap of pulling the financial plug, how do they do it in terms of the War Powers Act?
Well, what they'd have to do under the War Powers Act is not vote the continuation. But what's technically happening, but I don't believe it really is, at least I couldn't find anything going through the web pages on what Congress has been up to the last couple of years, is it's supposed to be re-voted every time it comes up every 6 months. And we the way we fought Vietnam was we passed the Tonkin Gulf Resolution, and that was appropriately reconsidered and re-voted every 6 months. That was the genesis of the War Powers Act to begin with, which came out in 73. And everybody decided that was kind of a loosey-goosey way to do business. So what the Democrats can do is they have two options. One of them is to force the president to do exactly what the War Powers Act says. He has to lay out what the objectives and duration of this conflict are. And to say, I want to bring democracy to Iraq, okay, boss, how long is that going to take? What's the duration? And he can't do that. Nobody can do that. And the law's there for a reason. What amazes me, Ian, is that some bright young lawyer someplace hasn't said, hey, I'd like to get an injunction against sending any more troops to Iraq because it's in violation of the law and the Constitution, you know, through the federal court system.
Well, in the absence of a bright young lawyer and political imagination or courage on the part of the Democrats, it seems to me that we're sort of in this Pavlovian situation where much of our debate has been about whether or not we have a civil war in Iraq. That seems to be whistling past the graveyard. The real debate ought to be whether or not it's going to turn into a regional war. And one of the few reporters that's, that really goes out into the field there, we just had on him a minute ago, and Brent Scowcroft alluded to this in his piece in the New York Times recently, that the Sunni who are being ethnically cleansed from Iraq are being pushed into Al-Anbar. There's a million refugees in Syria and at least a million in Jordan, a frail country. They're going to be angry, armed, funded by the Saudis, and they're likely to destabilize that fragile country of Jordan, not to mention Syria. And this will, in fact, put hostile regimes on Israel's borders and place them in much more jeopardy. So this is ultimately an extreme irony if you take the position, as many do, that the neoconservatives were in alliance with the Likud people like Netanyahu. So do you think that the country just has to endure this perfect storm of incompetence and geopolitical disaster in order to wake up?
I don't think Iraq can emerge and become a unified country again until they have had this war. There's a three-way civil war going on, and the administration can call it sectarian violence as much as they want to and deny that it's a civil war, but it is indeed a civil war. You have the Sunni versus the Shia, and then you have the Shia militia versus the Sunni. That's part of what's going on with this ethnic cleansing inside of Baghdad. And then you've got the Shia militia against the government that we are frankly propping up, as Mukhtar al-Sadr and the boys are angling towards the end state on how they wish to be in charge of this. You got Iran providing money to the militia. You got Saudi Arabia, as you mentioned earlier. I'm convinced they're providing money to the Sunni. There's more money floating around there than you can shake a stick at. And part of the plan, I guess, that the president's going to announce is that the Iraqis are going to bring in a brigade and a half to the five brigades we're supposed to bring in over the next 4 months, though God knows where you're going to get those from, other than they're probably going to turn units around much, much faster than a year. That's the only way you'll get them. And then you got these brigade and a half out of the Iraqis are supposed to be Kurds coming down from the north. Ain't going to happen. The Kurds are more than content to keep track of everything in their own area. And the more the Shia and the Sunni kill each other off, the happier the Kurds are. So, you know, we kicked this ant pile, we the president, and now we're standing in the middle of it. And, you know, to throw in 20,000, 30,000, 40,000, even 100,000 more soldiers into Iraq will achieve absolutely nothing. We can't put the cork back in the bottle.
And what about the extent to which the army itself, many have said that, that this could break the army, and that that is presumably one of the reasons why Abizaid and Casey resisted this, and maybe they found an ambitious general in Petraeus. I don't know. He gets a lot of praise in the press. But
I know Dave Petraeus, and ambitious is a very light word, very light.
I see. Well, but I understand, though, that the army itself is now scraping the barrel in terms of Category 4 recruits, aren't they?
That's been going on for a while. The real problem we're having in the army is, I grew up in the army in the 50s, and in those days, the company commander was married, the first sergeant was married, a couple of platoon sergeants were married, and that was about it. Very rare to have enlisted men married. Most lieutenants were not married initially. Well, the Army's different now. We're about 60 to 80% married. So you're a young wife waiting back at home, and you've seen your neighbors get the visit from the chaplain and the chain of command informing them that her husband's dead. And so you live in just abject fear the entire time that he's in a combat zone. He comes home. And he says, hey, I'm home. I got to go to the field. It'll be 6 weeks here, 8 weeks there. I'll be home for 2 weeks, 6 weeks, 2 weeks, dot, 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 dot. Oh, by the way, I'm going back in a year. And the wives can't take it. And they just say, that's it. You know, either you're going to stay in the Army or you and I are going to stay together. The divorce rate in the Army has just absolutely skyrocketed. And a lot of guys, when they look down the road and they say, okay, what's ahead for me? I get to come home for a year. I'll be busy that whole year, and then I'm going to go back into the combat zone. And then I'm going to come home for a year, and I'm going to be busy that whole year. Then I'm going to go back to the combat zone because it never ends. So we're losing junior officers. You know, the promotion rate to a major and lieutenant colonel in the Army, which is our field grades, these guys are key and essential. They're the guys that operate at the battalion level and the staff level. Is 100%. You know, if you'll stay, we'll promote you. Now, it used to be to get promoted to major was, oh, maybe 70%. Get promoted to lieutenant colonel was about 56%. 100%.
So it's no longer the meritocracy that it was.
Oh, hell no. Right. You know, it's we're so desperate in company grade and field grade officers that if you'll stay, we'll promote you. And the problem is what we're doing is we're watering down the Army. We're breaking it. We're just literally breaking it by asking too much of it. You know, if Mr. Bush wants to continue his folly, then he needs to implement the draft and get the American soldiers reconstituted and refitted with sufficient quantities of folks to make a difference.
Well, I guess, you know, just in closing, Colonel Chamberlain, it does seem that the great, almost an obscenity of this situation is that the American people really aren't fighting this war. It's the Army and the Marines and
that's right.
And their families. Yeah. And I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me, Ian, and
I wish you could end on a cheerful note, but I guess it's just there's no point in being Pollyanna here, Ram.
I pray every night to God that he will end this war.
Again, I thank you for joining us, Colonel Bill Chamberlain.
Hello again,
I'm Ian Marshall. Just speaking then with the Colonel Bill Chamberlain, who's a highly decorated 30-year Army veteran. He commanded a striking unit in Desert Storm, and he has been discussing the extent to which a surge will strain an already overstretched Army. I'm now speaking with Dr. Roger Stone, who's an economic geographer at Johns Hopkins University, the author of a recent study on the state of the Iranian oil fields and the projections of how they will meet the demands, particularly in terms of the highly subsidized domestic oil in Iran and the demands on their export. And some of this study was used by, I believe, the Iranian... was he the U.N. ambassador that wrote the piece in the New York Times?
The U.N., that's right.
Yeah, and you take exception to what he was saying, that...
Yeah, very much so. I guess I should explain maybe what I was talking about in this paper.
Sure.
It was released about a week ago by the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Following this, the Iranian ambassador to the U.N., Mr. Jafed Zarif basically used my argument to say that make the case that Iran's intentions with respect to its nuclear technology were entirely peaceful, which was almost the opposite of what I said in my paper. But what my paper was about was a projection of the possibility of Iran's oil exports declining to zero by the year 2015. Not that Iran would be out of oil by that year, but that Iran might be using all of its oil for itself. The Iran industry, petroleum industry, has three big problems. The first is failure by the state to reinvest in it. The second are the demand subsidies that you alluded to. The price of gasoline in Iran is around 30 or 35 cents a gallon, which is at or near the cost of production. So that leaves basically nothing left to put back into the industry. And petroleum is an industry in which you must reinvest because every oil well declines a little bit every year. So if you don't drill new wells to replace the natural decline of the ones you've got, you're going to be in somewhat of a bind. So they are burning the candle at both ends, if you will. They are producing less, and they're using more and more. So that that formula is a bad one from Iran. And I guess the third problem is Iran's inability to do anything about the first two. That is, they're not reinvesting, and their domestic demand is exploding from these almost free petroleum products. And they're unable to do anything about those problems. So they're in a bad way. What the ambassador, in my paper, I merely pointed out that the claim that the U.S. administration has made that since Iran has such vast reserves of oil and gas, which it does, it's number two and three in the world in those categories, therefore it must be the case that any nuclear technology activities that Iran is engaged in are of necessity some part of a weapons deception. all I said was that, at first, that I didn't doubt any of the suspicions that the IAEA had had with respect to Iran, but this willingness of Iran to degrade its industry, to disinvest in it, and to run the export base down, meant that a Russian reactor, a nuclear power reactor, could have a legitimate civilian purpose, that purpose being the substitution of nuclear generated electricity for electricity that would be generated there, presently generated from gas. So that was the gist of my paper. And what the ambassador chose to do with it was to, first of all, claim that it was a study by the National Academy of Sciences, which was in the scientific world, what he said, having said that, that's like plagiarism. My paper was published by the Proceedings of the National Academy, which is a journal, a peer-reviewed journal that could accept or reject my paper as they saw fit. So for the ambassador to have claimed that the Academy wrote the paper, only the National Academy performs studies for Congress alone, that the Academy wrote the paper was kind of like, let's say that I was on your show denying the Holocaust, and which I don't deny, but let's just say that I had done that, and then somebody else said that your station denies the Holocaust. So it's attributing this study to the National Academy, and they absolutely didn't do the study I did. And then secondly, I didn't say what he says I said. And then thirdly, he makes a large case about Iran's peaceful intentions with respect to its nuclear program, and I'm not an expert in that area, but I would point out that they've got a heavy water reactor, and every other heavy water reactor in the world has got a weapons use, and well, there are many other inaccuracies and obfuscations. But in any case, that's a long version of the story.
But Roger Stone, there's a lead article on the front page of Sunday's LA Times about how perhaps it's a strategy on the United States' part to deny oil field support and supplies and, you know, the stuff that Halliburton and Schlumberger provide, and that it has had an effect. I know there was a while back, there was the European subsidiary of Halliburton was fined for supplying equipment against the embargo. So how much has the embargo, in fact, been a strategic or a weapon against Iran in terms of creating the conditions that you're describing here?
Well, it's an important question, and it is a bit of a there's some subtlety involved here. I haven't read the article that you refer to, but what I can say with some confidence is that while the embargo, and this is, I believe, the U.S. An act of Congress called the Iran-Libya Sanctions Act, and it prohibits, as you suggest, U.S. firms from doing business in Iran. And there's a codicil to the, or an element of this act that allows the U.S. to take actions against foreign firms or foreign countries where firms are headquartered that do business with Iran. The first part of this act has kept the U.S. firms out of Iran, and that doesn't help them. I mean, the U.S. Oil and gas technology is the best in the world by far. And so that act prohibits Iran from choosing from among most of the leading firms in the world, but it does not constrict. But because the U.S. has not enforced this other part of the act against the foreign firms, which include firms from Norway, Britain, Italy, France, many of our friends, the act really has not constrained investment in Iran. Iran's problems with respect to its oil industry are almost entirely self-imposed. That is, they could get slightly better deals and maybe slightly better technology from American firms or American-based firms, but Royal Dutch Shell operates there, France's Total operates there, Statoil of Norway operates there, ENI, Respal. There are many, many firms working, and it's those firms that Iran is driving away. So while the U.S. Embargo doesn't help, it really it's not the critical variable here.
But what explains this disconnect then, Dr. Stern, where you've got, you said that there may be the second or third largest reserves of oil and gas in the world, and that Saudi, of course, the number one, and arguably Iraq number two, and Iran number three, and yet they're... you say by 2010 they won't be able to export.
So no, I'd say by 2011 their exports could fall by half.
By half, right.
Depending on what price does. Well, let's just assume price stayed what it was, that then their revenue would fall in half. Now, price is not something I can predict. If Iranian exports decline, as I suggest, there will be upward pressure on price. But what I think what you're asking is, how can they be so foolish to allow this to happen?
Yes. Well, what happened? I mean, the stuff is there, but they can't get it out, and something that must explain that.
Well, the explanation is... I'd just call your attention to the situation of the Soviets in the 1980s and 90s. This is a country that was also very rich in natural resources. They did to their oil industry in the 80s what Iran is doing to its now. If you are the mullahs and you're not very popular and your economy, your political power is based on the redistribution of profits, monopoly profits from your oil production, your short-run political investment in taking money and investing it in an oil well that will take 4 or 6 years to yield actual cash. So your short-run return, political return on that is zero. If you're unpopular or you're worried about your popularity or if there's a constituency that feels it's entitled to something that you could give it now and postpone your investment for later, you'll have a tendency to do that if you're not an elected leader and your popularity depends on your ability to distribute welfare. And Iran has a vast welfare state. And the answer to your question really is that Iran is like the Soviet Union. We forget, because we're kind of fixated on the Islamist rhetoric that comes from the regime that is so frightening, that Iran it's a socialist economy. They've got the 5-year plans, the state-run industries. They've got everything the Soviets had, and they went bust. So the answer really is, it's philosophical. There's no rational economic explanation from inside a capitalist perspective, but from the Iranian perspective, there's simply no incentive within these state-run industries to make profit-maximizing moves. It's much easier for the state to simply pilfer the revenues of the state oil firm and distribute them to maintain their grip on political power.
So, Dr. Roger Stern, to buttress what you just said, you know, in terms of the fact that they do have a domestic constituency that doesn't necessarily like them. There was a reversal in terms of the recent elections at the municipal level against the mullahs. So clearly, in fact, arguably, that's the constituency that the United States should be going after rather than threatening them, because
I strongly agree.
Because if you threaten them with nuclear to blow them up, that just drives the people back into the hands of the mullahs, and that appears to be...
There was an argument, and I'm sure you've seen it circulating in the neoconservative circles. And before I bash the neocons, I want to say that there are some important principles of neoconservative thought to which I agree, and that is that the Saudis are not our friends, and they have no oil weapon that is held over us, and we should conduct our foreign policy in our interest, not out of fear from what they might do to us. But the notion that there is a viable military option in Iran, and I'm not qualified to say whether our Air Force the Air Forces of our Navy and Air Force are capable of destroying this nuclear technology and weapons capacity. I don't know that. But what I do know, or what I'm very confident of, is that an attack on Iran now would do for the mullahs what Saddam Hussein's attack did for them in 1980, and that is to unite a country behind some very unpopular behind a very unpopular regime. So my suggestion, and I don't make this in the paper so much as in talks like this with you folks in the media, is that our best policy is to wait. That is, the regime is doing a fine job of destroying the Iranian economy. And that's bad news for the Iranian people, but I don't know what policy the U.S. could undertake that would help them. So let's let them finish the job of that and hope that the unpopularity that comes of it will not lead to adventurous wars against the Iranian neighbors, but to the success of opponents of the regime.
Well, just in closing then, it may not be your expertise, but how do you explain what's going on domestically here in terms of the disconnect between the fact that the price of oil is going down at the well, but going up at the pump?
Well, that is a long discussion.
Give me 30 seconds worth of it then.
Well, 30 seconds worth is that there is an oil cartel. If it wasn't there, I think the price of oil would be $5, $6 a barrel. At an oil price that low, a lot of violence that's both underwritten by monopoly profits and violence undertaken to secure those profits, as in Iraq's wars against Iran and Iraq, against Iran and Kuwait, would not have occurred. So that's the short answer to a very complicated question.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Dr. Roger Stern. Again, Dr. Roger Stern is an economic geographer at Johns Hopkins University and the author of this study on the state of the Iranian oil fields in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. I thank Lewis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer.